Right. Good evening and welcome to the second of David Atwill's lectures on the way in which J.M. Coetzee transformed or has transformed his autobiography into fiction. And David, as you know, is professor and head of the Department of English at the University of York, and his latest book, J.M. Coetzee and the Life of Writing, is based largely, I think, on David's research at the University of Texas at Austin, where the J.M. Coetzee papers are kept and all the many fascinating writers' notebooks and annotated manuscripts, which reveal so much about Coetzee's creative process, but also in a general sense about the creative process anybody might go through. So the book will be for sale. I think it's at a special price of 200 Rand. Don't want to do anybody down. Will be for sale afterwards. And just thank you, David, for coming again, and especially to talk about this fascinating book, troubled and troubling book in the earth. Thanks.
Thank you, Fionnuala. Thank you very much. Very warm welcome. And thank you all for coming. It's always lovely to be back in Cape Town and to be at UCT again. I'm going to organize this presentation around the idea of the shot tower. This is the cover of the first edition of John Coetzee's novel, and this is a shot tower. This one no longer exists. It was alongside the Waterloo Bridge in London. Now, Petersburg never had a shot tower. It would have been prohibited because it would have been taller than the Winter Palace. Shot towers are a feature of British and American cities in the late 19th century. They were designed for the manufacture of ammunition. Molten lead was dropped through a sieve at the top of this tower, and by the time it hit a pool of water at the bottom, it was sufficiently rounded to insert into a shotgun cartridge. If you Google the shot tower on Stalyani Quay or the shot tower in Petersburg, you will be taken straight to the Master of Petersburg, to John Coetzee's novel, because there was no shot tower in Petersburg. He puts one in the city. So it's Coetzee who gives Petersburg its shot tower, albeit an imaginary one. Now, I'm going to organize this lecture around this insertion, which I think is really quite brilliant for reasons that I hope I'll be able to explain. But there is at the core of this novel a very troubled, unresolved, and I do want to make that claim, unresolved grief, which looms over this text, rather like the shot tower over Petersburg. Without being absolutely certain, I suspect that this is the shot tower that Coetzee is familiar with. This is an historical image of it. It's in Baltimore, Maryland. And that's what this shot tower looks like today. I don't know for sure, but I suspect that John Coetzee visited it during one of his visits to Johns Hopkins University. Coetzee's shot tower, as I was saying, is a brilliant insertion into the urban geography of Petersburg, because it appears to belong so organically and intrinsically to the world of the novel, which is full of obscure motives and dark threats. You will remember the chapter in the novel is called The Shot Tower. It falls in right in the middle of the book, chapter 10 of 20. The scene involves the novel's fictional Fyodor Dostoevsky being led up the stairs of the tower at night to be shown the point from which his stepson, Pavel, fell to his death. His dubious guide is Nechayev, the leader of a revolutionary movement called the People's Vengeance. The creed of the People's Vengeance is social leveling at all costs, to be achieved by any means, including assassination. According to Nechayev, Pavel was assassinated by the police for his involvement in this movement. Dostoevsky, we're talking about the fictional Dostoevsky in Coetzee's novel, Dostoevsky suspects it was Nechayev himself who murdered Pavel. To exacerbate the tension between the two characters, Dostoevsky suffers from epilepsy. The possibility of his following Pavel into the abyss of darkness is real. And I quote here from the novel, he grips the railing, stares down there into the plummeting darkness, between here and there an eternity of time, so much that it is impossible for the mind to grasp it. So the shot tower works very well in the dramatic sense. But since it's such an incongruous structure, I want to use it to focus discussion on the incongruities of the novel. The fact that Coetzee puts Cape Town into St. Petersburg of the 1860s and 1870s. The fact that he put South Africa in its transitional years. The novel was written between 1991 and 1993. It was published in 1994. Puts South Africa into the Russia of the late Tsars, following the abolition of serfdom in 1862. But especially the fact that Coetzee inserts into Dostoevsky's life and work an episode of profound personal grief, an episode that is very far from the historical truth. As a result of that, as a result of Coetzee inventing an episode of profound personal grief for Dostoevsky, Dostoevsky scholars have been puzzled and even slightly outraged by the novel's playing fast and loose with the historical facts. If you look up Coetzee's name in a guide, a critical companion to Dostoevsky, for example, notably the one edited by W.J. Leatherbarrow, a very fine Dostoevsky scholar, you will see that the Master of Petersburg is covered in rather slight terms. About it, Leatherbarrow says, it's an interesting, if historically unreliable, fictional account of the period in Dostoevsky's life when he was working on The Possessed. And Dostoevsky's extraordinary biographer, Joseph Frank, says, it's regrettable that Coetzee did not include a warning to his readers, many of whom will be unfamiliar with the details of Dostoevsky's biography, not to take his fiction as fact. Many will no doubt do so for the same reason that, as Dostoevsky complained, people thought he had murdered his wife because this was the crime imputed to the narrator of The House of the Dead. Unquote. Joseph Frank, is surprisingly unreceptive to Coetzee's purposes. The most important alteration of the facts that Coetzee makes is that he has Dostoevsky return from Petersburg to Dresden, where he is evading his creditors on hearing, that his stepson has died. He uses a false passport in the name of Ishaev, thus pretending to be Pavel's biological father. His purpose in going back to Petersburg is to establish what happened at Pavel's death and to collect his belongings. This is all Coetzee's invention. The actual Pavel survived Dostoevsky by some years, doing various clerical jobs until his death in 1900. Now, in Joseph Frank's reading, this alteration by Coetzee is never convincingly explained. And he says, the theme that dominates Coetzee's early chapters, Dostoevsky's desire somehow to keep Pavel alive in memory and his guilty despair at his failure as a father, all this becomes quite tedious after a while and less artistically persuasive, unquote. He ends by calling The Master of Petersburg an enigmatic and rather puzzling book whose aim is difficult to unravel, unquote. Let's put aside the question for the moment whether Joseph Frank might have worked harder at taking the novel on its own terms and ask whether there might not in fact be something in the novel that this very fine Dostoevsky scholar is in fact responding. It is the case, after all, that even amongst Coetzee's most sympathetic critics, The Master of Petersburg regularly elicits comments like Frank's, enigmatic, puzzling, unresolved. It is a troubling and, in fact, a troubled text, I will argue. The issue that critics skirt around, while frequently mentioning it, is the fact that the novel is strongly autobiographical. Coetzee lost his son Nicholas in a desperately upsetting accident in April of 1989, in which he fell from the 11th floor balcony of his flat in Claim Street in Hillbrow. The standard position amongst the critics on this is to mention it and then tactfully move on, as if to say, we know that this novel is autobiographical, but since our professional self-respect depends on the taboo against biographical reading, we won't dwell on it. So it's mentioned, but then circumvented. I would like to look for a different way of approaching this problem. We could go back to what is no doubt the most powerful source of the taboo against biographical reading in literary criticism, namely T.S. Eliot's theory or doctrine of impersonality. Another source for the idea of impersonality in the work is in the work of the French post-structuralist theorist Roland Barthes, who wrote an influential essay called The Death of the Author, some of you will know it, in which he argued that the published text renders the author who stands behind it illegible. Barthes, incidentally, later revised his ideas when he published a book about actually preparing oneself to write a novel. And in this later work, the author comes back. But in literary criticism, and those of us who are English teachers or English lecturers know this only too well, when a student starts explaining a work with reference to the biography of the author, out comes the red pen. It's routine. It's a very firmly held position. So a novel like this troubles that orthodoxy a great deal, a novel that is so deeply autobiographical. We need to work out how and why. Let's go back to Eliot for a moment. In the course of making the argument about the impersonality of the artist, in his essay Tradition and the Individual Talent, Eliot refers famously to Hamlet, saying that Shakespeare failed to resolve the problem of Hamlet's suffering because the play's source material, which lies in revenge tragedy, was too flimsy a vehicle for Hamlet's feelings. That is to say, Hamlet's despair over his mother's behavior was too weighty and distressing a subject for the narrative provided in the sources that Shakespeare was using. And therefore, Shakespeare could not establish what he called an appropriate objective correlative. Well, Coetzee is facing a similar problem in The Master of Petersburg. The manuscripts make it possible for us to trace the genesis of the novel, where it is very clear that Coetzee begins by writing as an act of mourning. This is also the case, incidentally, with Age of Iron, where the early manuscripts mourn the passing of his mother. Let's remember that The Master of Petersburg comes immediately after Age of Iron, so having completed one novel in which grief over a lost loved one was transmuted into fiction, he undertook the excruciating task all over again. John Kannemeyer's biography assembles the evidence pertaining to Nicholas's death and the relationship he had with his father. I'm not going to go into those details here. Suffice to say that the circumstances of the death point to an accident. There were rumors in Cape Town of security police involvement, rumors which resurfaced after the novel appeared, because the security police of the 1860s Russia certainly play a prominent role in the text. There were also rumors of suicide, but the evidence for those conclusions is unconvincing, as Kannemeyer shows. The most likely explanation is that it was indeed an accident. The fact that the relationship between father and son was strained would have compounded the family's anguish. The manuscripts include the following passage of memoir written nearly 2 years after Nicholas's death. What kept him calm at the funeral service, what gave him an air almost of equanimity, was the vow he had made that he would write his son into immortality. That was why the promise of resurrection held out ritually by the priest, hollow as the promise of the Redeemer, who after 20 long centuries had not returned and clearly did not have it in his power to return, a promise whose pathos wrung the hearts of those around him, left him dry-eyed. His son was dead. Very well. There was then a task before him to reassemble those scattered atoms, or the ideas of those atoms, to give to the boy a modest, limited immortality, the only immortality available on an earth spinning towards its death, life in one of those boxes shelved row upon row in the mausoleums called libraries, which once a year or once in a decade would be opened and read, and the dead people interred in it allowed to renew themselves in the souls of the living. Manuscript material that obviously would not make it into the text, but which is certainly part of Coetzee's preparation. The use of the third person here deserves some comment. We are familiar with third person narration in Coetzee's fictionalized memoirs in Boyhood, Youth, and Summertime. Here we find it being used in a passage of aid memoir in notes written into the manuscript where the purpose is to steady and focus a developing painful narrative. Clearly, the third person covers a range of positions, from the most personal to the more ironic and detached. But even in this apparently very personal passage, it signals a movement towards fictionalization. Coetzee is becoming the fictional Dostoevsky in this passage, even if the fictional situation is not yet fully established in the development of the work. The manuscripts reveal that the genesis of a number of Coetzee's novels is autobiographical in a similar way, or when not directly autobiographical, then often local and historical. I've mentioned that Age of Iron started with passages of mourning for a departed mother. He began writing that roughly a year after his mother Vera's death. Waiting for the Barbarians starts on Robben Island, not in its fictional empire, as we were discussing last week on Thursday. We are now learning that the Coetzee we know, for all his famed narrative control, the intertextuality, the metafictionality, the self-consciousness, the aesthetic detachment, we know that those qualities are the consequence of exhaustive revision. Typically, he writes through the personal and also the locally circumstantial in order to reach a point of abstraction or in order to sublimate the personal, to write himself out of the story. But the outcome in all of these fictions would not have the compelling quality that it has if it were not for the fact that they all carry the original structure of feeling along with them. We can see this beginning to happen in the following, I think, exquisite passage from the early manuscripts of the Master of Petersburg. Again, this is writing that did not make it into the final text. A turn of the head, the line of an eyebrow, a figure disappearing around the corner. In all of these, I mistake you, and my heart lifts for a moment, lifts as a wave does, and then goes down again. Mistaken, taken by the wrong thing, taken in, like an abandoned lover catching glimpses everywhere of the lip, the eye of the woman who abandoned him. What was one has become distributed. The beloved is everywhere, scattered. Fragments of the beloved body torn up like the body of Osiris, of Orpheus. Young men who had too much, glowing, dore, Christos, golden-bodied. Now a matter of gathering together the golden hoard, putting together the scattered parts, assembling the broken body in its perfection again. Poetry, listing the parts so that the eye, leaving the page, will for an instant have before it the image of the whole body, resurrected, mistaken then to see you everywhere in this town where you lived? No, we are all distributed. My gait, my way of turning is repeated in the clown, the oddball who parades the main road every morning with his bag of empty bottles. I repeat the tight smile of the woman in the laundry. Only when you are gone, only when I am gone, only when the woman in the laundry is gone, does that trace carried by another body wake this sense of loss. I think you must agree with me that this is where Coetzee's talents just emerge as being quite astonishing. And it's, to me, rather sad that this material did not make it somewhere into the book. But you can see what he takes himself through in order to be able to write so exquisitely. In this passage, incidentally, doré is French for gilded, and chrysos is an ancient Greek word for gold. Let me turn now to the novel's development. As I do this, we might bear in mind the following statement as a way of explaining the intensity of the process that Coetzee takes himself through. I can't promise to cheer you up this evening, but I hope that you will be moved by this material. The process of fictionalization begins with the idea of writing the departed son as the character Stavrogin in The Possessed, Dostoevsky's novel The Possessed, which is also sometimes translated as The Devils. In the early months of drafting, Dostoevsky is mourning not the stepson, but indeed a son by his first marriage, Nikolai Fyodorovich Stavrogin, later named after his mother. This is a fragment of the manuscript from the 3rd of June 1991. The idea was Stavrogin. The idea was that his son could be resurrected in Stavrogin, if Stavrogin could be resurrected for the death to which Stavrogin's maker had consigned him. It was an audacious idea, since Stavrogin's maker was Fyodor Dostoevsky, and the death to which Stavrogin had been consigned by his maker, a powerful death. But the idea could not be forgotten, which is to say, he thought, he must have faith in it. What he thought was, there must be life in the idea, or else it would die. It is a matter of finding the life. It is a matter of bringing Stavrogin back and finding why it is that a voice says, in Stavrogin he can live. And then it is a matter of making Stavrogin live again. That is, in the first, a matter of taking him, Stavrogin, away from that powerful, dark old man who had wanted him to die. Now, Nikolai Stavrogin is the leading character in Dostoevsky's novel. And I hope I can be clear about the differences between Dostoevsky's version of these events and Coetzee's version of these events. So Nikolai Stavrogin is the leading character in Dostoevsky's novel. The action is driven by Peter Verkovensky, who is the fictional counterpart to an actual historical figure named Sergei Nechayev. Nechayev was the author of a notorious pamphlet called The Catechism of a Revolutionary and the murderer of a student, Ivanov, at the Petersburg Agricultural Academy. Dostoevsky uses these events as the basis for his plot. The guiding spirit of the revolutionary circle that Verkovensky draws around himself is Stavrogin. Initially, Stavrogin is referred to as the prince in Dostoevsky's drafts. He was to be the anti-hero of a moralistic tract called The Life of a Great Sinner. As The Possessed developed from this tract and other sources, Stavrogin's stature grew. If you were casting a film of The Possessed, you would want Johnny Depp to play the leading role of Stavrogin. With his noble background, his Byronic arrogance and sophistication, Stavrogin continues Dostoevsky's critique of the revolutionary tradition, whose origin is linked to Bakunin in the 1840s. In The Underground Man and in Raskolnikov in Crime and Punishment, Dostoevsky registers his distrust of this movement, its irreligious, egotistical rationalism, its spiritual vacuity, which is seen as the worst of liberal Western influence. The name given to this movement, the tag given to this movement was nihilism, not because it lacked principle, but because it rejected rejected all morality, in fact, in the interests of political calculation. Dostoevsky's Russian Orthodox beliefs played into this position. Having been convicted himself as a member of the Petrushevsky circle, he spent 10 years in a Siberian prison and then a labor camp, during which time he became convinced that rational schemes to transform society, such as those he had himself espoused earlier, would never work because humanity was too weak. So he arrived at a theological conclusion. The solution lay not with the Catholic Church, which was too close to political power and to Western materialism, in his view, but it lay with the narod, the people, the Russian soul, which had spiritual integrity. This anti-rationalist, anti-nihilist critique was underpinned then by Dostoevsky's own personal journey. Stavrogin, though in this tradition, is peculiarly opaque in the possessed. His evil is matched by a certain mysteriousness which doesn't become clear until the very end. He was meant to achieve greater definition in a final chapter called Stavrogin's Confession. Sometimes this chapter is translated as At Tikhon's, Tikhon being a monk to whom Stavrogin is making a confession. He confesses that he has raped a child and failed to intervene in her suicide. This attempt to achieve a clean breast through the confession to Tikhon the monk, however, fails, and Stavrogin hangs himself. In that episode, Stavrogin would have become more distinctive, but in fact, the chapter was censored from the book. It was considered too shocking by Dostoevsky's editor, Mikhail Katkov, who was publishing the novel serially in his journal, The Russian Herald. Now, the fact that Katkov refused to publish the final chapter put Dostoevsky in an almost impossible position with this novel. He was having to make retrospective alterations to the drafts before they were published, removing some of the foreshadowing of this final event. That is the preparation for the encounter with Tikhon. When the novel was collected and published as a single book in 1873, the censored chapter was still excluded. It was only in 1922, some 60 years after, close to 60 years after it was written, that the censored chapter was found in Dostoevsky's archive on the death of his wife Anna Dostoevsky, translated and then published by Virginia Woolf at the Hogarth Press in London. Now, Coetzee's manuscripts do indeed begin by sketching the suppressed chapter of the possessed. So critics have been assuming that the basis of Coetzee's novel is his writing of this suppressed chapter. There's some truth in that, but it's not a sufficient explanation. Instead, the focus of Coetzee's novel is on how Dostoevsky comes to create the character of Stavrogin. And in this respect, Coetzee tackles a question which has preoccupied Dostoevsky scholars. Edward Vasiolek, for example, who edited Dostoevsky's notebooks, tells us that Dostoevsky comes to the character of Stavrogin at the pace of a tortoise. He resists the real Stavrogin by evasions, by twists and wrong turns. He gives this prince the wrong words, the wrong actions, the wrong loves, the wrong feelings, unquote. So Vasiolek is arguing that Dostoevsky's genius lies in the way he stalks his character, thus enabling him to acquire more influence and more menace. Here is a slide from Dostoevsky's notebooks where this indirection is very clear. So all of this makes Stavrogin a figure of deep strangeness and mystery, otherness, an obscure presence. We know that it's an evil influence, but we haven't yet fully come to terms with this character as readers. As a presence, Stavrogin puts pressure on the author too, and on the process of creation, entering the novel from a source seemingly beyond the author's control. Now, it's into this indeterminate space that Kutsir inserts his novel. This is one artist speaking to the creative process in another. It's into this indeterminate space that Kutsir inserts his novel, proposing quite brilliantly that the indirection of Dostoevsky's writing was the result of grief. As if he could not focus on Stavrogin because he was writing his son as Stavrogin. And the grief was a kind of shimmering awkwardness that he couldn't quite control. In other words, it was the death of a child, the desire to incarnate him back into life, that drove Dostoevsky's quest for Stavrogin and that made it more difficult. As I see it, this is in fact at the heart of Kutsir's novel. In certain respects, Kutsir's process in reinventing Dostoevsky was similar to that of Dostoevsky's process himself, that powerful dark old man that he writes about in the manuscripts. Kutsir, too, proceeds by indirection, constantly revising plot situations in order to release different perspectives, ideas, and outcomes. Early on, Dostoevsky is in Switzerland when he hears that his son has been arrested. He is still a son at this stage, called Nicholas or Nikolai Stavrogin, not Pavel, the stepson. He is angry with the son and delays his return. Later it emerges that the son has committed suicide, and so begins the father's quest to find out the truth about what really happened, a truth that he thinks might be different from the official accounts. When Kutsir abandons this narrative before moving on to another take on this material, he writes in his manuscript, "I used to be able to write stories quite easily. I would write down one or two people on the page and they would get talking. And pretty soon there would be the beginnings of a story between them. Then all I would have to do would be to pursue them like a faithful dog till the story worked itself out. Now it is all changed, or seems to be. Now I am like a dog without a bone. I dig here, I dig there, I dig up the whole garden, but nowhere do I find it." Amusing, but also a confession of the difficulties he's having producing the novel he has now committed himself to. He tries out a situation in which the child, who becomes Matryona in the novel, the daughter of Pavel's landlady, Anna Sergeyevna. Matryona commits suicide, thus recalling the events of Stavrogin's confession. He attends the inquest and he sees the mother for the first time, that is, Anna. And there it emerges that Stavrogin has confessed everything under interrogation, and everyone who knew him is appalled by what he has done, and so he commits suicide. The mother and the father of the departed children then begin a relationship during which he discovers that the mother is in fact complicit in the daughter's suicide. Needless to say, this rather frightful plot is also abandoned in Kutsir's novel. 7 months into the project, Kutsir crosses out Nikolai Fyodorovich and enters Pavel Alexandrovich. This is a crucial development, marking the switch from son to stepson. So the process of fictionalization has taken another step now. Instead of writing about a son called Nikolai, he's now writing about a stepson called Pavel. So it's as if Coetzee is beginning to get some control over the material. In the same period, he begins recording a good deal of naturalistic detail from Dostoevsky's letters and from Joseph Frank's biography. The political aspect of the novel also begins to take shape now, with Pavel associated with the revolutionaries. He records details of Dostoevsky's life in Dresden, with Fyodor traveling to Wiesbaden and Hamburg to gamble. This is one of Dostoevsky's proclivities. He begins to invest Dostoevsky with pedophilic desire for the child Matryona, and he explores the possibility of somehow transferring this venality onto the son, onto Stavrogin. That does actually happen in the novel. Once Nikolai or Nicholas becomes Pavel, the manner of his death is settled with remarkable pragmatism. And here I quote from the manuscript. "Drop the notion that Pavel dies falling from the fourth floor of number 63, Svechnoy Street. Number 63 only has three stories. The third floor, Dostoevsky thinks, is not enough to die from. Instead, Pavel must die by falling from the shot tower on the banks of the canal. His body will be brought to the apartment the morning after. The police surgeon will arrive and decide he died from falling, not the result of an assault." Unquote. So the chapter called The Shot Tower could now be written. It's entered into the drafts. Apart from dealing with the plot, Coetzee works into his revisions ideas drawn from mythology, notably Orpheus and Eurydice, as you would expect, with Orpheus going into the underworld to find Eurydice and retrieve her. He explores biblical intertexts, notably the story of Abraham and Isaac, as you might think, the father-son relationship there. He explores the idea of Kairos, which is a Greek but also Christianized concept, which means revelation through crisis. He refers to the philosophy of Immanuel Levinas, the Jewish ethical philosopher, and he comments, having read Levinas at some length, "The Greek tradition is scopic. That is to say, it's based on vision, sight. In the Hebrew tradition, to have regard for somebody is not to look at him or her with the gaze of desire." He borrows from other novelists, notably from Saul Bellow on aging, and he rereads Franz Kafka's famous letter to his father. As might be expected, the Russian scholar of Dostoevsky, Mikhail Bakhtin, features prominently in Coetzee's note-taking. Coetzee works with Bakhtin's idea of the carnivalesque, for example. Bakhtin had this notion that in medieval carnival, at least the non-religious forms of carnival, but also some of the religious forms of carnival, the peasantry was overturning the cultural hegemony of the upper classes and especially the aristocracy. So Coetzee works with Bakhtin's idea of the carnivalesque, as that which disrupts official narratives. He wants to ensure that his characters are not, and this is a quotation from his manuscripts, are not frozen in their social types, unquote. He introduces the idea of Pavel as a shape changer, of Dostoevsky himself becoming a shape changer by taking over and wearing Pavel's white suit. Pavel wears a white suit in this novel as a sign of dandyism, as a sign that he's not wholly reliable. This is part of the characterization of him as Stavrogin in Coetzee. So I'm excluding lots of twists and turns in this narrative as it evolves. One could certainly write a book on each of the 12, 13, 14 versions of each of these novels. So I'm lifting out what I see as the core narrative in the creative process. 2 years into the project, Coetzee had developed the plot more or less as we know it, but he still had to write the conclusion. And he writes in his notebook, "It occurs to me that I have now more analytical descriptive notes on Netchayev, as well as others, than I can ever incorporate by naturalistic means. I now must simply do it, which means having FMD," this is Fyodor Mikhailovich Dostoevsky, "sitting at the table of his son's room, creating Stavrogin out of the ghost of the dead son, as it were. Or," and to continue with Coetzee's notes, "or finding Stavrogin within himself, or expelling the devil by identifying the devil as Stavrogin." And here we enter into the final stage of the novel and this peculiar, very odd transformation that takes place in the novel's final chapter, which is indeed called Stavrogin. The novel ends, as we know, with the chapter called Stavrogin, in which Coetzee's Dostoevsky writes a stream of obscenity into Pavel's diary, in the knowledge that the girl, Matryona, will read it. Matryona being the daughter of the landlady, you will remember. So she's in the apartment where Pavel has lived. The diary is there. Matryona will be curious about this diary that belonged to Pavel. Dostoevsky now, in Coetzee's novel, writes obscenities into this diary so that Matryona will read them. Question, why does he have his character do that? I can't discuss the final chapter in great detail, but suffice to say that this conclusion is a metaphysical experiment of a typically Dostoevskian kind. The idea behind the obscenity is to throw down a gauntlet to God, as it were, to see if he responds. Do something evil to see whether or not God responds. That's the logic behind this final act. It's deliberately cynical. It corrupts the child, Matryona, and of course it also betrays Pavel. Dostoevsky, in other words, abandons himself to an act of perversion, commits his authorship to an act of perversion. And in doing that, he experiences this dizzying disorientation. The metaphor that comes up again and again for this obscene moral act is falling. And indeed, at one stage, this novel was going to be called Falling, until Coetzee discovered that there was already a novel in circulation with that title. We have Pavel's death, of course, but we also have Dostoevsky's epilepsy, which is often narrated as a kind of falling. So the idea of falling acquires a multidimensional relevance. The final passage achieves what the fictional Dostoevsky desires. That is to say, Pavel emerges as the prototype of Stavrogin, the revolutionary who has no moral principles, who will stop at nothing in the interests of his political rationalism. So the son has been transformed and immortalized into the great work through this intrusion of the father's writing in the son's diary. Now, the question that we need to ask as readers of The Master of Petersburg is, well, what does this passage of writing achieve for Coetzee and Coetzee's purposes? And the answer to that can only be ambivalent, I want to suggest. He specifically withholds any suggestion that the process is redemptive. Dostoevsky in the novel writes, "He has betrayed everyone. Nor does he see that his betrayals could go deeper. If he ever wanted to know whether betrayal tastes more like vinegar or like gall, now is the time." Then the novel ends with the line, "Now he begins to taste it. It tastes like gall." The sense of betrayal seems to refer to Coetzee as much as it does to Dostoevsky. Now here is a page from the final section of the manuscript where the feeling of betrayal is most fully expressed. And perhaps I should read just the final paragraph here. They pay him to write books. He will put aside his... Oh, it's so tiny on my computer screen. Can you read it? Can you help me? There, he will put aside his books. He will put aside everything. He will go naked as a babe into the mouth of hell, following the shade. He will do anything, pay any price to bring his son back. Notice that it is by betraying the son, by representing him as evil, that the character can come into being, the character in whom the son is immortalized. So the novel enacts the strangest of solutions. As an autobiographical fiction, it is paradoxical and, I believe, unresolved. A grieving father, let's just stand back for a moment from the material that we've been looking at. A grieving father, Kutsir Dostoevsky, writes a dead son, Nikolai, back into existence in a work of fiction. By definition, the son can only emerge from the father's shadow by becoming other to the father, by assuming his own being. The father knows this. The father is not an ordinary novelist. The father knows this. And so he has to invent a situation in which he can lose himself, become other to himself, in which the son can begin to emerge from his peripheral vision, as it were. The ruse works, but only up to a point. The son is written into the great book, and will achieve a kind of immortality there. But this solution doesn't feel like victory. And so the novel ends contemplating a feeling of betrayal. It tastes like gall. Mikhail Bakhtin, that Russian scholar of Dostoevsky, argues that Dostoevsky was a master of what he called the dialogic novel. And the dialogic novel is a novel in which the author's voice doesn't dominate, but is distributed amongst the voices of the characters. The author, Bakhtin said, had to cut the umbilical cord uniting the hero to his creator. If this was not done, this is Bakhtin still, if this is not done, then what we have is not a work of art, but a personal document. So the author has to cut the umbilical cord between author and creation. If this does not happen, then it's not a work of art, but a personal document. Well, the question asks itself, doesn't it? Is the Master of Petersburg a personal document in Bakhtin's sense? The fictional Dostoevsky might be a dialogic novelist, but is Kutsir in this novel a dialogic novelist, like his powerful forebear? Does he manage to make this novel impersonal? I'm not convinced. Could any author, for that matter, who had recently lost a son, devise an impersonal story about an author writing a son back into life? In a situation in which art and life are so entangled, as in this case, Bakhtin's argument, in fact, seems rather simplistic. Joseph Frank, let's go back to Dostoevsky's most distinguished biographer. Joseph Frank was wrong in that Kutsir is surely free to make up a Dostoevsky for himself, to do as he pleases with Dostoevsky's story. But perhaps Joseph Frank was right in one respect, and that is that the grief in The Master of Petersburg is not fully motivated or explained. And so it's only by examining the process of creation that we begin to understand properly the scale of the challenge that Kutsir set for himself. And this is where I would like to come down finally in my reading of this novel, shifting the emphasis away from the final published text and away from all of those taboos about not reading biographically. If we don't do something like this, then we never understand the scale of the challenge that Kutsir actually set for himself, and we diminish him as an artist by understanding the process less adequately, by insisting that we only need to look at the final text. So we end up admiring the process, more than the outcome, in my view. The shot tower as a metaphor for Kutsia's intrusion into the narrative of Dostoevsky retains its incongruous looming intensity as a sign of unresolved emotional turbulence. Now I'm going to change the tone slightly, and I'm going to end by looking at the question of how the novel puts South Africa into Dostoevsky's Russia. This will take me 5 or 6 minutes, and then we can have some discussion, perhaps. There are two moments from the manuscripts that I want to share with you on this subject, in which Kutsia himself quite explicitly makes the connection between the novel that he is writing and the South Africa of the time. There are other ways in which the novel connects with the country that I won't dwell on. For example, in the clashes between the police chief Maximov and Dostoevsky over Pavel's personal effects and Pavel's writing, but an interesting discussion of censorship and how we are supposed to read. But I will pass over those interactions. I want to come back to these two moments from the manuscripts that to me are interesting and revealing. The first moment is sobering. The second moment is comic. And so I'll try to end on a comic note. This is an extract from Kutsia's manuscripts, written on 19th of November, 1991. Think about the date. 1990 is the start of the transition with the release of Nelson Mandela. The novel will be published in the year of the transition, in 94. So he's writing it in those transitional, that interregnum period. I have been left behind by South Africa as it enters Africa. Horror of irrational violence, of a vision I can all too easily believe in but can't afford to believe in because my self-culture rests on a denial. FMD in the same position. Pavel Nechayev call up a vision of casual and even serial killing to which he has a twofold reaction. He, by the way, is himself. He's using the third person about himself, to which he has a twofold reaction. A, denial, abhorrence, wish that the offenders should be locked up. B, retreat into the past, into old age, as he sees that this is what the new world is and wants. Unquote. Well, what do we make of this? It's a kind of tinderbox, isn't it? When you come across a passage like this in a writer's manuscripts, you need to tread cautiously. The idea of being left behind by South Africa as it enters Africa is, of course, the lead up to the democratic transition of 1994. And amongst other things you could say about this, it's certainly a foretaste of the vision that will inform Disgrace, which is the next novel that he will write. He begins writing Disgrace in 94. You could say, if I might digress just for a moment, that Kutsia's wanting to write a novel about a man who is publicly humiliated, who does not live up to the climate of moral triumphalism that is around him, that decision in the writing of Disgrace is informed by the writing of The Master of Petersburg. It's a very Dostoevskian approach to take to that euphoric triumphalist moment of the Rainbow Nation. Kutsia, like Dostoevsky before him, would have been saying the moral triumphalism of the period is unpsychological, unrealistic. Something else is going on here. So it's a very deep and skeptical treatment of the culture of the time. So there's something in this passage which is a foretaste of the next novel, Disgrace. And it's surprising how early Kutsia registered this anxiety, isn't it, when so many liberal-inclined whites were optimistic about what the Mandela years would bring. But against that reading of this passage, we could look at it another way. We could look at this passage in another way. I think we could also say that the writer in Kutsia is actively seeking a connection, an imaginative connection, a personal connection with Dostoevsky. This is again one artist learning very deeply from another artist's creative processes. So he's actively seeking a connection with Dostoevsky, looking for resonances in Dostoevsky's creativity that he can follow. The connection is exaggerated in this piece, but since Dostoevsky feared irrational violence, Kutsir follows him, despite the politically objectionable implications. So Kutsir will follow Dostoevsky wherever he leads. So it does reveal that Kutsir's first loyalty, despite the possibility of political opprobrium, is to his art and not to his country. Well, that's the more sobering note. Here's the more comic note. It goes like this. Kutsir records in his manuscripts, the manuscripts of The Master of Petersburg, watching a film of the stage production of Sarafina, which he very amusingly misspells Serafina, that is S-E-R-A-P-H-I-N-A. I don't think deliberately, I think it was just a mistake. And he is struck, he says, in the notebook, by the relentlessness of the dancing, the gesture, the physical being of children or actors playing children. As we all know, though some may not, Sarafina was a commercially successful musical based on the Soweto Revolt of 1976. Now, from watching Sarafina, Kutsir derives Nechayev's principal accomplice in the novel. Her name is Katri, and she's a rather hapless Finnish girl. Matryona, the daughter of the landlady, gives to Katri poison so that when she is captured, she can kill herself. In Dostoevsky's view, the writer's view, she should go back to her home in Karelia, which is a pleasant holiday countryside on the Russo-Finnish border. But instead, Katri, as a rather innocent person, is sacrificed in this act to the political machinations of Nechayev and his circle. Now, the dancers of Sarafina are clearly Kutsir's prototype of Katri, because after he mentions watching the film, in the same paragraph, he writes this in his notebook. Nechayev does not come. Instead, an agent of his comes, a girl even more relentless than he. Short, almost squat in her muscularity. She seems 12, but is in fact 21, a Finn. In the novel, Katri is described as a girl dressed in a dark smock, such as a novice nun might wear. Her face is round and unexpressive, her hair drawn back lightly and gathered in a brief queue. Well, could this be none other than Lilletti Kamalo in her school gym slip, white blouse, socks and shoes, rocking to the music of Mbongeni Ngema? I think quite possibly. So with the music of Sarafina ringing in our ears, in conclusion, let me give the last word to Kutsir's Fyodor Dostoevsky from the novel. I am not here to live a life free of pain. I am required to live, what shall I call it? A Russian life, a life inside Russia, or with Russia inside me, and whatever Russia means. It is not a fate I can evade. For Russia, read South Africa. And I'll stop there. Thanks very much. Sure.
If some people want to leave early but still want to buy a book, could the publishers identify themselves if you want to sneak around there as you go out? But David is going to take some questions.
If there are any questions, don't feel obliged. Thank you.
Not being able to evade South Africa, but in a very real sense, he has evaded South Africa.
Right. We could have a long seminar about this. I'll do my best. The assumption is often that he left South Africa as a result of the controversy around the publication of Disgrace. That novel comes out in 1999, if I'm not mistaken. In fact, as early as 1995, he was in communication with the Australian embassy about securing a visa. So he was at the very earliest stages of writing Disgrace, and it was not yet clear what form that novel would take. So I think the departure for Australia has to do with his retirement. He's looking for a town where people would not be on his case as they would be if he'd stayed in Cape Town. Have you been to Adelaide? It's gorgeous. It's like Peter Maritzburg in the 1950s, you know? It's uncomplicated, lots of Victorian architecture, and it's very quiet. It's where you might want to retire if you'd lived a controversial and very full life. And you know, I don't think it's surprising. I think he ends up in Australia for much the same reasons as many South Africans end up in Australia. You know, I don't think that he was immune to the same kinds of apprehensions and misgivings and anxieties, to be perfectly frank. So is that an abandonment? That would be a harsh judgment, wouldn't it? Having said that, I mean, I have no issues with him moving to Adelaide. But I would also say that as many people have remarked, you know, he might be able to leave South Africa, but South Africa remains part of him, whether he leaves the country or not. And I think he acknowledges that, and is in fact perfectly willing to acknowledge that fact. And I do think that his fiction is at its core informed by the historical plight and the ethical dilemmas of his home country. The novels that he has written since Disgrace and since his departure, he left in 2002, have been essentially, as I see it, allegories of authorship. So in other words, they are no longer these anguished encounters with a particular historical situation. It was South Africa that made that possible. And I would go further and say that he was wanting to emigrate in the 1960s. He was forced back here because he got arrested in campus turmoil on the campus of the State University of New York at Buffalo. There was a university president there who called in the National Guard and had a group of junior faculty arrested when they conducted a sit-in outside his office. John Coetzee was one of them. They were all convicted of trespass. Later, the conviction was overturned on appeal, but in the meantime, he lost his right to permanent residence. So for the Americans there, it was inconsequential. In fact, they could wear it as a badge of honor. For John Coetzee, it was catastrophic, and for his family, it was catastrophic. They were wanting to emigrate then, and they were forced back. So for the next 30 years, he writes all of this fiction about a country he loves deeply, but which he is trying to leave, and which he actually only manages to leave in 2002. So, you know, it's a long and complicated story, and I think a story that we can perfectly well understand. But I like to think that university president who called in the National Guard and had him arrested didn't know that he was making a Nobel Prize winner in that gesture. Yeah. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you. Go ahead.
Just a very quick one. I very much enjoyed your discussion last week on sources, which would serve exhaustively.
Thank you.
Yes. As knowing a little bit about Russia and Russian culture,
yes.
I was fascinated to see rereading The Master of Petersburg this week. Edgar Alexander Bloch's poetry, for instance.
Interesting.
Yes, we are Asiatics, we are marvels. It comes up as a sense. Did he
That's such a lovely and helpful comment. He certainly did, and as always, the breadth of his reading is astonishing. He read all of Dostoevsky, for example, not only the great novels, but also the letters and the more obscure short fiction. He read Vasiulek's study of the notebooks. So he worked his way into Dostoevsky's life and imagination until he could feel almost like a brother to him, you know, looking over his shoulder as Dostoevsky wrote, and it's into that writing that he inserts himself. Yeah. But not only Dostoevsky, you know, all of the great Russian novelists. It's clear that he's absorbed Turgenev and Tolstoy and many others. And of course he was reading the poets then, and he continues to read them now. What a critical biographer like myself can't possibly do in any single study is do justice to all of the cultural work that goes into the writing of one of these novels. What I've tried to do is lift out the drama of composition, but I'm very conscious that the cultural work that goes into the drafting of these novels extends beyond what I can accomplish in a book on this scale, let alone a lecture. There is just so much there. And the manuscripts, as a result, will fuel scholarship for a very long time to come. I should mention on that score, by the way, that I was told by the head librarian in the manuscripts library at the University of Texas, where the manuscripts are kept, that they've never seen such interest in any single author's work. They had, at one time, 6 scholars working on Clouzier's papers, and apparently that's a record. So you know, like Beckett's papers are there as well, and I think in due course these will be extensively studied and written up. He is already, by the way, the most reviewed and studied novelist of all of South Africa's literary history, with more books and articles and theses and dissertations written about him than any other writer. This is not my opinion. This is based on the research database that is collected by the National English Literary Museum in Grahamstown. They keep records of all these things. And Disgrace is the most researched novel in South Africa's literary history. It has just recently eclipsed Alan Paton's Cry of the Beloved Country. So what are the implications of that? A Swedish friend, who's also a wonderful scholar of South African writing, Stefan Helgeson, said to me recently that we need to realize, he wasn't lecturing, but he was saying this, and he was saying this to me, we need to realize, I think he was including himself in the statement, that Disgrace is in 100 years' time is going to be remembered as the novel of the transition. That's quite a sobering thought. You know, I would want to, on the basis of that, I would want to issue a challenge to UCT. You know, what is UCT doing about the Coetzee legacy? Is it embracing it, as the rest of the world is embracing it, or not? I would like to leave that question hanging in the air. Are there other questions? Should we stop there? Thank you, Fionnuala. Good. Yes, you are. Of course you are. Lee, you are. Is the English department embracing that question? That's the question.